Hi everyone, and welcome to another edition of Dakota Digest. I'm Nate Weck, and thanks for joining me. Here's the top news for the week ending November 20th. Jewel Cave is now 180 miles long, and it contains a second lake. On a four-day exploration trip during the second week of November, cavers pushed into the deepest reaches of the world's third longest cave and mapped passageways past the 180-mile marker. Along the way, they found a new lake. SDPB's Charles Michael Ray has more on this exploration.
The exploration team found a second Jewel Cave lake about 100 feet away from the previous find earlier this year. National Park officials say this new passageway full of water confirms that Jewel intersects the Madison Aquifer. It's the largest underground body of water in western South Dakota. Mike Wiles is the chief of resource management at Jewel Cave.
So this is a direct window into the Madison. It will allow us to more accurately say where the water in the Madison goes. It may give us an indication later on how far the cave, at least the air-filled part of the cave, could extend, because as it goes farther to the south, it's going to eventually the whole limestone is going to dip below the water table. There will be more cave down there, but nothing that we could ever consider exploring.
The intersection with the Madison Aquifer also opens a door for new research on the microbial life in the cold and dark cave lakes. Researchers are planning to sample the water to study the rare bacteria that live there. Cave explorers have plenty of work left, too. Wiles says over the last year, exploration teams mapped a record 7 miles of new cave, and that includes some 300 new unexplored passageways that have not yet been checked. Wiles says it's even possible Jewel could pass the 200-mile marker in the coming 3 to 4 years.
A Lakota woman with ties to the Rosebud Sioux Reservation is one of 7 recipients of the 2015 Regional Artist Fellowship. Awarded by the Native Arts and Cultures Foundation, the annual grant recognizes American Indian emerging artists moving into an established career in the area of talent, knowledge, and expertise. SDPB's Jim Kent has more.
The Native Arts and Culture Foundation was created in 2010 to promote the revitalization, appreciation, and perpetuation of American Indian, Alaskan Native, and Native Hawaiian artists and organizations nationwide. Francine Blythe is the foundation's director of programs.
The fellowship program is very successful in the sense that it acknowledges the work of the emerging artists into established career in their area of talent and knowledge, expertise, and exposure. And the purpose of the fellowship is to enhance and provide more exposure and opportunity.
The foundation has supported more than 160 artists and projects throughout Indian country, including Alaska and Hawaii, through grant making, convening, and advocacy. This is the first year regional fellowships have been awarded in the Upper Midwest and Hawaii. That was good timing for Deani Whitehawk. The Sichangu Lakota painter and mixed media artist worked as curator for the All My Relations Gallery in Minneapolis since 2011 before going out on her own as an artist in March of this year.
The award is really has important timing. It's allowed me to pay my studio rent for the year and other things that I need to absolutely make it possible to branch off into this first year of full-time self-employment. Without support like this and support from the galleries that I work with and people that support my work, I wouldn't be able to do it straight away all by myself.
Deani Whitehawk believes she was born an artist. Her favorite kind of play was making things. After taking photography and drawing in high school and studying whatever art she could at Haskell University, the Minnesota-based artist attended the Institute of American Indian Arts. She then earned a Master of Fine Arts degree from the University of Wisconsin before working as curator for the All My Relations Gallery in Minneapolis. Deani explains her art by saying that everything she creates starts from what she knows best, herself.
But I use my own stories and my personal experiences to talk about the large stories of our tribe or of Native American experience within the United States, our relationships to the government and the kind of trajectory of Native history. So I use my personal story as a tool to talk about bigger conversations.
One of Deani's goals is to incorporate traditional Lakota quill work into her creations in order to perpetuate an art form she sees as essential to telling the story of her people. Adding the role of full-time artist to those of mother, wife, and Lakota family member will keep Deani Whitehawk busy. And as much as she's a bit intimidated by the responsibility the fellowship brings by its title alone, Deani is confident that its benefits will assist her towards success on her new journey into art. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jim Kent.
Avira Health is buying insurance organization DakotaCare. Company leaders are not revealing the purchase price. Talk started 2 weeks ago, and representatives for both entities could reach a final deal by the end of this month. Leaders say customers and employees likely won't notice changes in the short term. SDPB's Keely Boltina has the story.
The board chair for DakotaCare says health insurance reform can be good for consumers, but difficult on insurance companies. Dr. Kevin Bjordahl says sometimes making insurance affordable for a patient puts a strain on insurance providers.
We've had some instances where patients have gone to a healthcare facility to get care, and they've had bad diseases or bad conditions, and they've been walked into a room with a computer and signed up for insurance on the spot and utilize a lot of health care, and then the month after they're out, they quit paying their premium, and they've utilized a lot of care that the insurance company has to pay, and then there's no way of recovering any of that.
Bjordahl says DakotaCare offers health plans with doctors and clinics across health systems, and the company can benefit from Avera Health Plans, which covers a smaller provider network. DakotaCare is becoming part of Avera Health, but the proposal includes running DakotaCare and Avera Health Plans as separate organizations. Bjordahl says people who have health insurance with DakotaCare maintain the same insurance.
For the DakotaCare subscribers, nothing will change. Everything will be exactly the same. There's no change in their claims processing or their availability of providers or pharmacies or anything else. It's completely seamless. Down the road, there may be more options available, but that remains to be worked out.
A leader at Avera says customers and the company benefit by keeping both versions of insurance plans. Rob Bates is senior vice president of Avera.
DakotaCare offers a product line that is built around, again, that open access like we talked about with everybody in the state in the network, and that appeals to certain customers, and that has certainly a following in the state, and we wanted to be able to preserve that choice. Likewise, we think it's important to offer the choice that Avera Health Plans does for a value-based network, a bit more narrow network at a lower price point, and so the customer can choose what product best fits their needs.
Bates says each insurance company has about 120 employees. He says it's too early in the process to know what buying DakotaCare means for jobs.
With two insurance companies, we're going to have to look at efficiencies between the organizations, and I'm sure we'll find in ways that perhaps aren't obvious to the consumer that we can achieve efficiencies and synergies between the two organizations. We probably don't need two of everything that we have, so we can't really speculate on what impact that has on employment.
Bates says Avera Health is a large organization, so he says opportunities exist within the company if the insurance divisions eliminate jobs.
There is currently a national movement to involve more women in the science and engineering fields. South Dakota School of Mines and Technology is encouraging its female students to connect with one another through the Women in Science Engineering, or WISE, program. The school held an open house for the new WISE Center. SDPB's China Lockett has more.
The new WISE Women in Science and Engineering Center is tucked into a building on the School of Mines and Technology, or SDSMT, campus. The walls are covered with images of women through history and science-themed murals painted by the school's art club. WISE is a peer mentoring program that encourages women to build a support system and stay enrolled at SDSMT. The center hosts group activities such as art therapy and speaker series. Lisa Carlson is director of the WISE program.
It's really important for women students to connect to each other and have a space where they can come and hang out and do homework together, figure out problems together, attend small events, meet in mentoring cohorts, and then hear from women speakers across the community and in STEM fields.
Carlson says female students have taken ownership of the center in the few months it's been open. She says it connects them to WISE resources and staff members.
It's really important for women to be able to connect with other women and sort of visualize real mentors in the field so they can overcome the barriers that that are there for women in STEM. So this is a place where they can see that there are other women going through what they're going through, and they can lift each other up and build each other up and then forge those connections that are going to take them through their time here at Mines.
The WISE Center has a list of events planned for the remainder of the semester, including conversations on women in the media and a gingerbread construction contest. Events are open to students and faculty and SDSMT.
Some lawmakers on South Dakota's Education Task Force say they hoped for a more specific funding plan. The report from the Blue Ribbon Committee includes many precise recommendations. Some members say the final numbers don't go far enough. SDPB's Keely Boltina has the story.
The Governor's Blue Ribbon Task Force on Education Funding is made up of 24 people from state government, education, and the private sector. A 34-page final report details the panel's findings on K-12 education in South Dakota. It includes adding at least $75 million to schools' general funds and changing the formula the state uses to distribute tax dollars. Republican State Senator Deb Soholt says members did not reach consensus on all of the recommendations, but the report is comprehensive.
Our task was to provide recommendations for further statute development. And I believe that's what we did as a task force. And, you know, now we will get to the finer points of, you know, really putting meat on the bones. But I think we were very specific on what we wanted to do, to raise the teacher salaries, to do a teacher-student ratio, to put caps on reserves, to look at the pension levy differently, to provide an academy for new teachers, to provide mentoring dollars, to put more money into innovation for learning so we can deliver virtual educators as a subspecialist to any corner of our state so all of our children would have great education.
Soholt co-chaired the committee. Democratic State Senator Billy Sutton says the task force report does include many detailed elements, but he says the panel left some major portions for the governor to decide, including the best student-to-teacher ratio.
I think that we needed to drill down on that more and make a specific recommendation as well as a specific dollar amount. I realize that we put a floor on it, but we talk about being specific, but that's just a floor. That's not a specific dollar amount that education needs. And I think that we needed to drill down a little bit more on capital outlay. Now, with that being said, you know, we have made a lot of specific recommendations, but some of those larger ticket items, I think we needed to be more specific on.
Democratic lawmakers say they're working on an alternative plan to solidify the reforms they want to improve statewide education funding. State Representative Paula Hawk says the report is a recommendation to Governor Dennis Stuggart. She says he can be a leader by acknowledging South Dakota's challenge with a teacher shortage and educator salaries.
Best case scenario is him stepping up and saying, let's bring ourselves to a position where we are not last in our region, much less last in the nation. And let's fully fund this plan that we have, that we can pull our teachers up to being competitive within our region with our bordering states. Let's fully fund the plan. Let's fully fund improving education and keeping our teachers here and giving them a reason to want to be teachers in South Dakota and to stay teachers in South Dakota.
All three legislators say the fact that lawmakers and stakeholders are acknowledging challenges is a positive for K-12 education.
Former Rapid City Middle School teacher Andrew Hippica was sentenced to 25 years in prison for attempted enticement of a minor on the internet. The case involves 100,000 images of child pornography over a 2-year period and Hippica's recorded live chat videos of minors he convinced to perform sex acts over the internet. Federal Judge Jeffrey Viken also sentenced Hippica to a lifetime of supervised release. Viken calls Hippica a predator. Prosecutors say this case led to arrests around the country and worldwide. SDPB's Charles Michael Ray has more.
Andrew Hippica taught classes, including sex education, to middle school boys at a Rapid City Catholic school. Prosecutors say he was using his position to groom potential victims. Investigators found thousands of images taken from the internet and stored on Hippica's computers after a tip led to a search of his home. Sarah Collins is the lead prosecutor on the case with the U.S. Attorney's Office. She praises the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force for its work.
This case was one of the most disturbing child pornography cases that I have prosecuted. The sheer number of images and their content were shockingly violent and depicted unimaginable physical and sexual abuse and degradation of very, very young children. In addition, there were chats between Hippica and other people, including minors, in which Mr. Hippica would lie and entice them and manipulate them to get them to send images of themselves while naked.
The information obtained in the investigation in Rapid City was sent to Homeland Security in London, where a man who was corresponding with Hippica received an 18-year sentence for manufacturing child pornography and sexually abusing 7 children who were aged 3 months to 5 years. Brent Gomer is the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force commander and says the work of investigators helped to protect local children and those far outside Rapid City.
It's the most rewarding assignment I've had in law enforcement, in that I think that it is the only assignment that I've had where I feel that we can truly save children. There were 7 children saved in this investigation in the United Kingdom because of the efforts by the local Rapid City ICAC Task Force.
Prosecutors say this case was only successful thanks to the cooperation of local, state, national, and international investigators.
And that's going to do it for another edition of Dakota Digest. For more radio news and other programming information from South Dakota Public Broadcasting, visit sdpb.org. Be sure to connect with us on social media by liking South Dakota Public Broadcasting on Facebook. You can also follow our Twitter accounts at SODACPB, at SDPB News, and at SDPB Sports. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Nate Weck. Have a great day.